I found 26 January articles, I chose five for discussion. And then as far as notation articles are concerned, I found 8 neoplastic, 3 non-neoplastic, 2 reviews, and 8 case reports. I must tell you, I was a little bit disappointed with the quality of the articles. However, we do have a few good ones. The first one is actually from our own group. Tara and colleagues, and the colleagues are from Mayo Clinic in Rochester. The title of the article is Loss of MTAP as by immunohistochemistry is common in pulmonary sarcomatoid carcinoma and sarcomatoid mesothelioma. The background to this study is that differentiating pleural mesothelioma from reactive mesothelial proliferation can be quite challenging, as we know. Ancillary tests such as BEP1, IHC, and P16 fluorescence FISH are helpful tools to aid in this distinction. Immunohistochemistry from MTAP has recently been proposed as an effective surrogate marker for P16. And I don't know about you, but we do use that a marker in Florida. I'm sure you use it in Rochester as well. So the objective of this study was to investigate the usefulness of MTAP in distinguishing sarcomatoid carcinoma and sarcomatoid mesothelioma. The author studied well-characterized cases of sarcomatoid carcinoma, and equals 34, and sarcomatoid mesothelioma, n equals 62. The tumors were stained with for MTAP and BEP1. And here are the main results. So there was 34 cases of sarcomatoid carcinoma and 62 cases of sarcomatoid mesothelioma. The ages were similar, and MTAP loss was detected in 50% of sarcomatoid carcinomas and 61% of sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. So there is a very minor difference. BEP loss was not detected in sarcomatoid carcinoma. However, it was detected in 6 of the 62 sarcomatoid mesothelioma, so it's about 10%. So the conclusions of this study are that loss of MTAP expression by immunohistochemistry is common in pulmonary sarcomatoid carcinoma, about 50%. This rate is similar to what is observed in sarcomatoid mesothelioma, 61%. Therefore, MTAP IHC is not useful in distinguishing these two malignancies. MTAP loss is more common than BEP1 loss in the setting of sarcomatoid mesothelioma. So that's about this article. I did have one minor criticism. If you look at this This is from the abstract. It says there are little data. R doesn't go with little. This is basic English. Any other comments?
How that got by the reviewers, I have no idea.
I have a quick question. I'm just wondering about the MTAP loss in the sarcomatoid carcinoma. Is that also due to the co-deletion of P16 as the same mechanism for mesothelioma, or is it just lost by itself due to some other reasons?
My understanding is that, do you guys want to answer? My understanding is that actually it's not the two same, it's not the same two genes. So I don't know the answer to that. The two genes are close, but not related. But that's an excellent question, whether the loss of the other gene can be detected in sarcomate carcinomas. That's a good question. Maybe Anya or Mary Christine can answer that.
Yeah, I don't see Jen here. I don't think we looked at or she looked at that on the molecular level. And I know from the mesotheliomas, there are rare cases which do not show the deletion in tandem for MTAP and CDKN2A. Yeah, there are two different genes, that's my understanding. And usually they are kind of altered in tandem, but not always.
And at the same time, P16 is commonly altered also in non-small cell carcinoma. So it's kind of probably a bit of both.
So you didn't focus at all on the BAP1 in your results, or at least Andras didn't pull it out. Max has been using it to distinguish, you know, meso from carcinoma. I checked with Andy, he said he's not comfortable, but your study would seem to suggest that you could use that fairly reliably in distinguishing carcinoma from meso?
Honestly, I wouldn't, because so this was only in the sarcomatoid, but for instance, in thymic carcinomas, we also see loss of BAP1 in the carcinomas. And I know in other carcinomas, like liver and so on, quite a few of them show BAP1 loss, to my knowledge.
Renal cell carcinoma is another one.
Yeah. Well, I haven't used it in that setting, and you know, thanks for the additional.
And I believe BAP1 loss has been demonstrated at a low rate in non-small cell lung cancer. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right. He was using it, again, soft criteria, but I think like so many of these markers, people just start using them without data to support the use in specific settings. So, I mean, I think this is a great study, but that sort of stood out to me. Maybe you talk about that in the discussion.
Yeah, I think so, because we had discussed it. And it's probably in there.
I think the most common use is to, obviously, you all know that, to differentiate between mesothelium and benign mesothelial proliferation. Everything else seems to be a little sketchy.
Thanks.
All right, the next one. The differential prognostic impact of spread through air spaces, also known as STAS, in early stage lung adenocarcinoma after lobectomy, according to the PT descriptor. So the objective of this study was to evaluate the prognostic impact of STAS in early stage lung adenocarcinoma after lobectomy. The study population included 506 patients who underwent lobectomy with mediastinal lymph node dissection for PT1B, PT1C, and PT2A adenocarcinoma. The authors divided the study population into two groups, STAS positive and STAS negative, and they stratified them according to the PT descriptor. They used a Cox proportional hazard model and inverse probability to evaluate the prognostic impact of stents on recurrence-free survival and its independency in each stratum. So just as a reminder, not as you would need reminders, but PT1B is a tumor greater than 1 centimeter, but less than or equal to 2 centimeters. PT1C is greater than 2 centimeters, but less than or equal to 3 centimeters. And PT2A is greater than 3 centimeters, but less than or equal to 4 centimeters. This is the results. It's figure 3 in the paper. And according to this figure, stents was associated with poor recurrence-free survival in patients with PT1B and PT1C adenocarcinoma after lobectomy and mediastinal lymph node dissection. It's a recurrence-free survival. They mean the recurrence-free survival of PT1B and PT1C was similar to that of patients with PT2A adenocarcinoma, in whom stent status was not associated with the risk of recurrence. So, in conclusion, the presence of stents increased the risk of recurrence independently from other poor prognostic factors. Sorry about that. In patients with PT1B and PT1C N0 M0 adenocarcinoma who underwent lobectomy, but not in PT2A patients. The presence of stents in PT1B and PT1C N0 M0 adenocarcinoma was associated with a similar risk of recurrence to that of PT2A N0 M0 adenocarcinoma. Any questions about this study?
How did they control for the other prognostic differences between the two groups in terms of rate of lymphatic invasion and distribution of histologic types, that is tumor grade? Because those also differ between the two groups. Did they show that STAS was independent of those?
Yes, I believe so. So they did show it as an independent prognostic factor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I think it's pretty straightforward. Not too much new, but at least justifies us looking at some of these stents cases. Now, this is a very strange article, but I was committed to it, so I kind of went through it, and I've been trying to understand it. I still don't, but maybe you can help me. So, prognostic impact of the histologic lipidic component in pathologic stage 1A adenocarcinoma. So this is the background that the authors give, and I should have put this in between quotation marks, because several articles have reported a prognostic association with the radiologic features of ground glass opacity. We explored whether the histologic presence of a lipidic component had similar significance. So the objective of the study was, in my understanding, to explore if the histologic presence of a lipidic component has prognostic significance in PT1A adenocarcinoma. First of all, it's not entirely clear to me why they singled out PT1A within the PT1 group. However, the authors evaluated 380 surgically resected PT1 lung adenocarcinomas, classified them into lipidic positive and lipidic negative groups, compared the two groups' clinical pathologic characteristics, radiographic, ground glass opacity status, and disease-free survival. Again, reminders. So PT1A is, as we have already mentioned today, is less than or equal to one. Well, actually, we haven't mentioned it yet. It's less than or equal to 1 centimeters in greater dimension. PT1B, we did mention, it's a greater than 1 centimeter, but less than or equal to 2 centimeters. And PT1C is greater than 2 centimeters, but less than or equal to 3 centimeters. And the caveat is that for non-mucinous adenocarcinomas with a lipidic component, only the size of the invasive component is used to assign T category. Obviously, the same is true for tumors that don't have a lipidic component. So, unbelievable typos in the right in the beginning of the article. So, this is again from the abstract. It says 380 P stage 1A adenocarcinoma. That's not true. The total number of cases was actually 380. PT1A with the lipidic component was 80, and a PT1A without a lipidic component was 24. So it's not PT1A, it's actually PT1. So methods. Lipidic positive adenocarcinoma was defined as an invasive adenocarcinoma with any lipidic component. And lipidic negative adenocarcinoma was defined as an invasive adenocarcinoma without any lipidic components. Results. Of the overall patients with PT1, lipidic positive adenocarcinomas were found to have significantly better recurrence-free survival. But this significance was not reproduced in PT1 subcategories. Furthermore, the presence of the lipidic component was not an independent prognostic factor in the multivariate analysis. So again, just getting back to the Jeff's question in the regarding the previous paper, the multivariate analysis did bring out the same significance of STAS in the previous study. So again, these graphs show the same results for PT1 and PT1A, and the same figure C and D actually does show the same results for PT1B and PT1C also. So it looks like figure 1A that actually, lipidic positive tumors have better survival than lepidic negative tumors, at least in this initial analysis. The same was not true for PT1A, and then it wasn't true for PT1B and PT1C either, just in this global PT1. Now, to me, the whole thing doesn't make much sense, but the authors concluded that although lepidic positive adenocarcinomas tended to have a favorable outcome, the lepidic component was not a clear independent prognostic factor in P stage 1 adenocarcinoma. So back to this graph. So PD1A shows a little difference, but it didn't come out in the multivariate analysis. So my take on this, why would it be? Why would the lepidic component be a clear independent prognostic factor in P stage 1 adenocarcinoma? Only the size of the invasive component is used to assign the T category. If I compare a 1 centimeter invasive adenocarcinoma with an additional lepidic component and a 1 centimeter invasive adenocarcinoma without a lepidic component, obviously they are of the same stage, why would the tumor with an additional lepidic component have better recurrence-free survival? Maybe I'm missing something. Any comment or explanation?
Well, I mean, it might be follow-up to the Memorial Sloan Kettering data that showed a pretty significant survival advantage in lepidic positive adenocarcinomas, especially if you restrict that to those in which the lepidic component accounted for at least 50% of the tumor. But your point's well taken. I don't know that they had kind of the statistical evidence that that stood as an independent prognostic factor. I'd have to go back and look, but I think they did.
So just to make sure that I understand this, so they don't look at the overall tumor size, right? They look at the invasive.
I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look at the details. They were tumors that were 3 centimeters or less in size, and I think that referred to the total size. I don't know how they stratified in terms of the size of the invasive component. So I don't think it was the same kind of study design as this one. But it did show that if tumors no greater than 3 centimeters in size had a lepidic component of at least 50%, that their survival was no different from their adenocarcinomas in situ and minimally invasive adenocarcinomas.
So I think I understand that if we are talking about overall tumor size.
I believe they were. But I'd have to go back and refresh my memory because it's been several years.
I think that's justified our current staging and CAP guidelines, which tells us that we should measure and stage based on the invasive component. But once you switch to that mode, so you stage based on the invasive component, so you sort of ignore the lepidic or the ground glass component, then I don't know why would that the presence of that lepidic component give you a survival advantage. The only thing I could have I thought about this, and I thought maybe those tumors without a lepidic component had or were of higher grade, but actually most of them were acinar adenocarcinomas, so that's not true either. So I think there is some major confusion going on here, again, unless I'm missing something.
I think your point is well taken. If you have an invasive component of 1 centimeter, whatever extra lipidic you have, if it's 1 centimeter to 1 centimeter, why would your prognosis be different? That's your point, right?
Yes, that's exactly my point. So I don't know exactly, I mean, there have been several studies in the beginning of this whole lipidic deal, as Jeff pointed out, where they looked at the overall tumor size and the lipidic component, and they came to the conclusion that if that lipidic component doesn't matter that much, it's the invasive component that matters, and that's why we are staging based on the invasive component. But once you stage on based on the invasive component, that lipidic component really shouldn't matter that much intellectually. But again,
but then it becomes maybe the biology of the tumor. So the question is 1 centimeter, if are all 1 centimeters equal? So if you have a solid adenocarcinoma, that's 1 centimeter, and you have a tumor that although the invasion of the lipidic is 1 centimeter, the invasion maybe is not, or the overall tumor is just not biologically as aggressive. And that could be a reason. So yeah, maybe that staging of 1 centimeters is maybe that's not all equal.
But so that could be one of the reasons. But as far as adenocarcinoma subtypes were concerned, there were not much difference in this study. So you would think that the biology would show in the subtypes. So you would have higher grade tumors, micropapillary or solid, in the group that doesn't have a lipidic component. But that wasn't the case in this study. So
I have one question. You know, I have to look at the staging book manual again, but this prorating the size depending on the percentage of the invasive element is limited to the size of a tumor hole or size is like 3 centimeter or less, right? Say if the tumor is a 4 centimeter and invasive component is 60% and the lipidic is 40%, do we still like subtract the lipidic element from the size of the tumor to stage, or?
I believe so. So if you go, so I copied and pasted from the CAP staging formula or a template, and it says, and so this is a direct copy and paste from that. For non-mucinous adenocarcinomas with a lipidic component, only the size of the invasive component is used to assign TK.
So what I'm saying is, what I'm asking is, does it apply only to the overall size of tumor, 3 centimeter or less?
No, I mean, it doesn't.
Or any tumor, any size?
I believe it's any size. So if you have a 10 centimeter tumor with a 7 centimeter invasive component, that's 7 centimeters.
So for example, you're not allowed to call adenocarcinoma in situ if the tumor is over 3 centimeter, you know?
That's correct.
So again, I guess this rule applies to any size. That's what I wasn't quite sure.
That's a good question. So what happens? So just reading this, I would say that you have to, that's a situation that may not be addressed in the staging. All right. Cicatricial shell organizing pneumonia associated with fibrosing interstitial pneumonia, a clinical pathological study. And this is Dr. Fukuoka's group from from Nagasaki, I believe. So these are the studies that have described cicatricial organizing pneumonia. I believe Jeff is an author on one of them. I always go back to Beardsley to 2013, who described the same thing as fibrosing organizing pneumonia. And then Dr. Yusam, rest in peace, in 2017 coined the term cicatricial variant of cryptogenic organizing pneumonia, and then a few other studies followed. So again, the background that the authors provide, cicatricial organizing pneumonia is seen in not only cryptogenic organizing pneumonia, or I guess other forms of organizing pneumonia where organizing pneumonia is the main histologic finding, but also various forms of fibrosing interstitial pneumonia, for example, UIP, fibrosing NSIP, etc. So the objective of this study was to compare clinical pathological characteristics of fibrosing interstitial pneumonia with cicatricial organizing pneumonia and fibrosing interstitial pneumonia without cicatricial organizing pneumonia. So the authors collected 121 cases of fibrosing interstitial pneumonia with available clinical data. They classified the cases into two groups, fibrosing interstitial pneumonia with cicatricial organizing pneumonia and fibrosing interstitial pneumonia without cicatricial organizing pneumonia. And they compared the clinical pathological features. So these are the results which I collected from the extensive tables in the paper. So again, there was 48 cases of fibrosing interstitial pneumonia with cicatricial organizing pneumonia, and 73 fibrosing interstitial pneumonia without cicatricial organizing pneumonia.
Hey, Andres, can I ask a question?
Sure.
How much cicatricial organizing pneumonia did a case have for it to get into the with cicatricial organizing pneumonia camp? It was a one field, one slide, or did they have any sort of quantitative threshold?
That's a good question. And I don't know by heart.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's an excellent question. I'm not sure what was the cut off.
Thank you.
I can look into that. This table shows the distribution of the various fibrosing interstitial pneumonias in the two categories. So obviously there were cases of UIP, fibrosing NSIP, unclassifiable interstitial pneumonia, and other forms of fibrosing interstitial pneumonia in both groups. And I'm just showing this figure to demonstrate what the authors were going after, and to find these cicatricial organizing pneumonia components, in most cases they had to use elastic stains. So figure two in this paper shows a case of UIP with the cicatricial organizing pneumonia. A and B are H and D stained sections without much clarity, and then C and D shows elastic stains, which according to the authors highlight areas of UIP, with shown with the yellow arrowheads and also foci of cryptogenic cell organizing pneumonia shown by blue arrowheads. So I don't know whether you find this convincing or not, but this is what the authors were going after. Are again the most important clinical findings, which I collected from the extensive tables in the paper. So one is the percent DLCO, so diffusion capacity in the first group, so with cicatricial shell organizing pneumonia was 61%, and without cicatricial organizing pneumonia was 69%, and the difference was significant. However, after 12 months, this difference basically this difference was gone and became insignificant due to the significant improvement in the diffusion capacity of patients with a component of cicatricial organizing pneumonia. Another important factor that the authors looked at was whether these patients had any acute exacerbation. So this cicatricial organizing pneumonia did not predict any acute exacerbations in the following 12 months. Actually, there was one acute exacerbation in the group without a cryptogenic organizing pneumonia. So the authors concluded that cicatricial organizing pneumonia is a histopathological finding commonly found in fibrosing interstitial pneumonia. And obviously using an elastic stain in the cases of UIP, it can be separated from the fibroblastic plugs of cicatricial organizing pneumonia can be separated from the sclerosed fibroblastic that can be separated from fibroblastic foci of UIP, and this cicatricial organizing pneumonia component does not relate to decrease in pulmonary function or acute exacerbation. So it's a little complicated study, and I don't think I'm gonna try to tease out this cicatricial organizing pneumonia in fibrosing interstitial pneumonias. And in some cases of fibrosing in SIP, and it might be obvious. And actually, in our study with Anya, when we looked at COVID, post-COVID interstitial lung disease, we did find quite a few cases of with a component of cicatricial organizing pneumonia. But in the fibrotic phase of DAD, or perhaps in fibrosing NSIP, it might be an obvious component, but I would not try to personally tease it out in a case of UIP. Any comments or questions?
Andres, in looking at their methods, it looks like any amount got you into the study. And over half of their cases, they scored as score one, which meant minimal. And seven of their 48, they scored as score three, which meant predominantly. So it isn't clear to me what those patients had, but it didn't take much to get in the study, and over half of patients only had a little.
Yeah, thanks for looking into it.
Andras, did they? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, it's kind of interesting. I wonder if we could look at this from a different perspective, that, you know, patients who have organizing pneumonia, that fibrosis are so-called like a fibrosing phenotype, and maybe use it like as a backwards predictor. Like if you have a patient with OP and it's fibrosing, maybe they'd be more likely to develop a fibrosing interstitial lung disease in the future. I know that's a kind of a broad statement, but I've always wondered why some people's OP fibrosis and others don't.
That's a good question.
Yeah, so, you know, according to the study I did with the resident, basically, you know, any organized pneumonia may not resolve, you know, that's the fibrosing organizing pneumonia or cicatricial organized pneumonia. So as you can imagine, OP can be, you know, present in any fibrosing lung disease in a small amount, you know, we just basically ignore, right? If it is a major component, then we have just regroup and what the disease may be. So the study we did, I think it's less than 100 cases altogether for the outcome. They didn't affect, and which doesn't surprise me because it's quite stable process, you know, it just didn't resolve. But, you know, unless it is everywhere, it's probably just making a little dead space that will not function. But overall, they will not impact the prognosis. So that's my take. And I'm not sure it has anything to do with the future development of the, you know, fibrosing interstitial lung disease per se, but I guess that's, you know, subject to investigation or question. But according to my study that I did, it just didn't seem to be anything special, you know, basically.
You know, it bothers me. I mean, bothers may be the wrong word, but, you know, people have looked at this from different standpoints. Sam's cases were all cryptogenic. Andy chose a pattern and found that it was associated with everything from aspiration to Ehlers-Danlos to, you know, cryptogenic cases. And just throwing this out there without saying what it's due to, is it, were these people aspirating? Were they on a drug? Were they, I mean, you know, I don't find studies like this very useful for that reason, but especially when the term has been used to describe a whole lot of different underlying causes. It's cryptogenic, or, you know, cicatricial organizing pneumonia is not a disease.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, so my study had all comers, and I didn't limit to, you know, any particular category. I came up with organizing pneumonia as a major just a morphologic condition, but I mean, just exclude any obvious, you know, like cause of OP, like severe infection or tumor next to it, you know, that kind of things. So loosely, but I didn't, you know, limit to, you know, cryptogenic organizing pneumonia. So it's more looser group, include many secondary causes, you know, like connective tissue disease, for example, you know. So any kind of OP as a major morphologic conditions, not, you know, entirely idiopathic, but excluded other severe confounding factors. So anyway, my idea was this pretty non-specific thing, you know, just to tell from, you know, fibroblastic foci, sometimes the fibrosis and the partly remaining organizing pneumonia in a fibroblast may mimic fibroblast foci. So they can kind of lead to the diagnosis of UIP. I thought that was more, you know, important thing to tell from.
Hi, Dr. Kaur, I have a quick question. I know we don't have much time, but in the table you presented the DLCO data. I think that you say that there was a change in delta DLCO in the cases that did have cicatricial OP, right? I don't know if that's difference is significant. But I mean, even though it's not a disease, you know, I think it's interesting to see, you know, that functionally the cases with cicatricial OP maybe may do differently from a DLCO standpoint from the ones that don't have cicatricial OP. So I think that's, in some way, it's important. It's showing that, you know, there are like clinical differences between these cases. It's funny because they have a lot of cases. They could have shown some statistics, so I don't know if that's significant or not. Do they mention anything about that in the discussion?
So the point that they are making it is that there was some difference in the DLCO between the two groups to start with, but that difference anticipated disappeared after 12 months. So that's basically the.
For me, it looks the opposite, because you see it's plus 5.8 change in the LCO after 12 months.
So it became, so it was worse to start with 61 versus 69, and then gained about 6.
Yeah, but that, what I'm saying is probably cicatricial OP is better because you may have an insult and then heals. That's what I see this data, you know, but I don't know if that's significant or not, that change in delta.
Were those patients treated with steroids when they had OP, like in?
Yeah, they were treated.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So we are out of time, but very quickly about the last one. So this, just so that you are aware, they described this diffuse cystic lung disease in sickle cell anemia in 22 cases. And I don't know how much we know about pulmonary complications in patients with sickle cell disease, but it looks like acute complications mainly represented by, but it pulmonary complications appear to be the most significant complications of this disease. And there are acute and chronic complications, and the cystic lung disease appears to be a new one. The patients hunted for mechanism, the CT showing the cystic change, and they actually had histology only in one case. And that case showed constrictive bronchiolitis, as you can see it on the right side of the this figure. And then they discuss the potential mechanisms cyst formation in patients with sickle cell disease, and they conclude that it's most likely related to a bronchiolar mechanism. So that's it. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Andras.
Thank you.
Thank you.